today we're going to be talking about Islamic law, and I thought I would start by taking whatever point struck you from what you read, either in my chapter or in the first chapter in the Forte book that was assigned, and any questions or comments, and we run out of that, I'm going to give you a sort of a pocket history of the early centuries of Islam as sort of a little setting for what this is going on.
I wanted to ask you, relationship between Arab customary law and Islamic law.
Yes. The particular point that struck me with both Sharia and Jewish law was that it looked as though you had the fossilized remnants of a feud system. That the Bedouin system pretty clearly still is a feud system. It's a feud system based more on tribes than on individuals. The Somali system, which we'll be discussing later, is a feud system, and one based on sort of on coalitions that are based partly on kinship and partly on contract. And the Icelandic one is a feud system, but a feud system in which there really are no long-standing coalitions beyond sort of parent and his adult sons kind of thing, but there are people who are friends, allies, and so forth. So they're all feud systems in the sense that the basic mechanism for enforcing the rules is the threat of the private use of force. It's a decentralized system. And of course, there are lots of feud systems in the modern world that we don't think of them that way. Ways in which you enforce people by enforce things by the fact that if you act badly, people will treat you badly. Kind of thing. Yeah.
I'd be interested. Do you think that this kind of system could work in a pluralistic or very diverse community? Because it seems to be like it depends on agree, like presupposed agreements between the members. And a person's not adhering to social norms.
But that's assuming that the reason that you obey the rules is because you agree with them, and it doesn't have to be. If you think about sort of, if you remember the idea of shelling points in bargaining, where sort of the standard example is two bank robbers have to split the loot, and they don't have very much time because the police are following. They agree to split it 50-50, even though each one really believes he's entitled to more than half, because 50-50 is sort of a natural dividing line. And there are a lot of other contexts in which sort of you've got a bargaining between people and they coordinate on what seem like natural lines. So if you imagine a system like the Icelandic one for a moment, where you have a court system, you have a legislator, what you don't have is any enforcement of those rules by any government body. You could certainly imagine in a system like that that even the people who in one respect or another don't agree with the rules will still say, well, yes, I understand that if the court rules against me and I don't pay the damages, you'll come kill me and my friends won't help me and your friends will help you, whereas the other way around, if the court rules on my favor and you don't pay the damages, the same thing will happen. So you can imagine a case in which you have some institutions generating outcomes that served as shelling points for the bargaining. I mean, the underlying fact in all of this, really, is that violent conflicts have net costs. So that, therefore, if I'm threatening to try to kill you, there's a whole range of outcomes that both of us prefer to that. Right? You're living and paying me tribute. You don't like that, but it's better than my killing you. You're living and paying me a fairly small amount. I might still prefer that to killing you, depending on why I want to kill you. So there's a bargaining range. And where there's a bargaining range, one thing that might determine it is the existence of sort of what people see as natural points. Yeah?
Well, my understanding of showing points is that they'll eventually settle on outcomes which seem natural to them.
But natural doesn't mean just.
Right. And so, society which is very plural or has many communities, what is natural, will find it difficult to find shelling points.
That's where I was suggesting that in such a society, something like the Icelandic court system might be the solution. That you have an institution which gives answers. And even though it doesn't enforce those answers, having given an answer by itself is enough to create a shelling point.
Sure. So it gets back to my question. Do you think this system could survive in a very diverse population?
Which version? The Icelandic version, because the Icelandic version is still a feud system.
The Somali system.
That I don't know. I think that would be much harder. And the impression I got from the stuff on the Somali system is that within the clans, and the clans are big, a clan I suppose could be a million people kind of thing, that within a clan, conflicts almost always end up being settled peacefully. conflicts between the clan, between people of different clans, there are mechanisms for peacefully settling them, but they don't work nearly as high a fraction of the time. So that would be analogous to your case, that within the clan, the people are more likely not only to have similar views, but to trust the same arbitrators, as it were.
Sure. Yeah, there's the discussed judges, and how judges often, they'll bring in principles of law which they've either created from whole cloth, or like they'll settle on what the community tells them. Neither one of which seems particularly conducive to a society with many ideas.
Yeah, it would be. I think the Somali system is going to be harder with a more diverse society. I think that's right. That's why it's an interesting point, because it does seem to be the Icelandic system could work just as a standard, the kind of system we have can work in a society with differing ideas, as long as most people who see verdicts as unjust don't feel strongly enough to be willing to fight for it when they're likely to lose. I mean, I don't know. I wonder what percentage of the American population doesn't have some law they obey which they think is unjust. If you think about things like tax law, that my impression is there's hardly anybody who approves of the tax system. Some of them may approve for bad reasons, for good reasons. Some of them disapprove because they think it ought to be a flat tax. Some because they think the rich ought to pay more. And yet, only a very, very small number of people are tax resisters. And I think a lot of that is, the stakes aren't large enough. My feelings aren't strong enough to be willing to bear the large costs associated with doing it. So I think you would have a system like that. So, but let me go back to your question. So my point is that if you look in both Islamic law and Jewish law, you see what looks like a fossilized remnant of a traditional system, and a traditional system, I think, for the Islamic is better one.
I was asking about Arab customary law.
What do you mean by Arab customary law? That is, I think of the Bedouin as the sort of the norm. Obviously, not all pre-Muslim Arabs were Bedouins. Muhammad wasn't. But
I guess I'm looking more in contemporary times. I mean, the Islamic law really wears it in Saudi Arabia.
But as you know from the chapter that we read for today, not my chapter, but the chapter in the Forte book, he's arguing that essentially no society has ever been a pure Sharia system or very pure.
I agree with that, but to the extent that.
But what else is there? And the Shah's argument is that Sharia itself embodies a lot of Arabic custom or of Sharia law from back at the beginning. But from his general discussion, it seems likely that in any actual country, what's really coming out is going to be some mix of what can be deduced from Sharia and what the people there see as right. And again, in the Somali case, Somalia is a Muslim country, and it's pretty clear that on some issues, the decisions tend to go according to Islamic law, and on some issues, inheritance, I think was one of the ones that was mentioned in one of my sources, it goes by traditional Somali custom, which is not the same rule as Islamic law. And I think there were some others, I don't remember which ones.
It appears to play more of a symbolic role. I mean, look at the constitutions of Arab countries. It seems like a lot of them make reference to Sharia law, at least in the preamble. Or at some point
But I think at this point, it's an interesting question. Turkey is the one country I know of which sort of explicitly disavowed it back at Ataturk.
But that's not a country.
Yeah, but it's a Muslim country. But I don't think there is any are there any countries that don't have legislation? I don't think so. That in a sense, a pure Sharia system, and it's clear from the stuff we've read that that's not what you really had, but a pure Sharia system would be one. All the government did was to appoint people learned in the law to be judges and then take what they said. And I doubt that exists now, and I don't ever have. So I think what you've always had is some mix of the judges are supposed to rule according to Sharia, but the judges are appointed by the state and therefore are going to be biased towards what the state wants, and there are legal mechanisms being enforced that are outside of Sharia, which is discussed by the source in some detail.
It does play a role in some form of family law throughout the
war. I'm sure it plays a role in it, and I do not know whether there are cases in the Somali, if I remember correctly. Well, inheritance is family law. In my memory, I'd have to go back of one of the sources, was that inheritance was one of the things where the Somali don't mostly follow the Sharia rules. And there's also, of course, always the problem of figuring out the distinction between what's really happening and what the law says. Have I told you I may have told you my story, the 200 dinar story about a woman forcing her husband to divorce her.
Yes.
Oh, I did tell her, and I won't tell it again. It's one of my medieval Islamic sort of law and econ stories. And the real bottom line is that if that although the law only lets the husband divorce the wife and not the wife divorce the wife can make being married to her miserable enough so that the husband will divorce her if she wants to, and there's no real way to stop that. That's the implication of that anecdote. Now, it turns out I noticed reading the 40 thing, something I hadn't realized, that there is a mechanism, according to one of the four schools, by which a wife can, in effect, sue for divorce. And it's analogous to the Jewish solution, that in both of those systems, formally, husbands can divorce wives, and wives can't divorce husbands. And the Jewish system, about 1000 AD, the law, interpretation of the law was changed in that a woman could not divorce her husband, but she could go to the court and give the court reasons why the court should compel her husband to divorce her. And apparently, in one of the four schools of Islamic law, as I understood what I was just reading, a woman can sue for non-support along those lines. A woman can go to the court and say, under Sharia, my husband has an enforceable obligation to support me. He's not supporting me, therefore you should compel him to divorce me. So that was sort of interesting in terms of ways in which the sort of system gradually works around certain potential problems. But I don't know a lot about modern Islamic systems. I'm really more interested in the history of Sharia and the early systems that I am in the modern ones. And of course, the Saudis themselves are a bit odd because they're coming off of a fundamentalist, I think 17th or 18th century fundamentalist group, the Wahhabi, which is sort of very much a minority position. That one of the things you see in Islamic history going way back is that every once in a while you get a bunch of enthusiasts. Bunch of people. You sort of have a society that was founded by true believers, and then you have the impression it sort of gradually dies down, and we all do things this way, this is the way things are done, but I'm not planning to go out and die for it. And then something happens, and somewhere you get a new group of enthusiastic true believers, and they can be very important. I'm thinking actually of the Spanish North African history, where you've got a period well after the initial conquest where there's been the Muslim princes, the Andalusian princes of Muslim Spain are fighting each other, and the Christians are gradually pushing south, but down in North Africa, there's this Almoravid movement, which is one of these fundamentalist revivalist movements, and so the Andalusian princes say, hey, we got a problem, and they invite Yusuf, who's the head of the Almoravid movement, to come in, and he comes in with his army, and drives the Christians back, and he settles everything, and goes home again. And you get the same pattern like 100 years later with the Almohad, which is another similar one, when the Almoravids have gradually sort of slid down. There's an interesting book about 14th century. There's a North African political scientist for the Ibn Khaldun, a fairly famous figure. And he has a sort of cyclical theory of history, and based obviously largely on the Islamic experience. In his cyclical theory of history, you have a ruler, and the ruler has got a tribe he's part of, and they're all loyal to each other and related to each other and so forth. But over time, that system breaks down because the ruler regards his closest kin as dangerous. They're the potential usurpers, so he tends to kill them off or repress them. Furthermore, in the initial period, the ruler believes in Islam, and since Islam only sets a certain specified set of taxes, which aren't terribly high for certain purposes, you have sort of low taxes and prosperity, but then over time the ruler becomes more and more luxurious and less religious, and the system gradually slides down, and furthermore, because he's broken the links to his tribe, because he's gotten rid of the close kin, now you have less and less. Meanwhile, out in the desert, there's a new tribe coming, and eventually the new tribe comes in, it overthrows the ruler, and the cycle starts again. So it's a sort of cyclic thing. And my favorite bit in that is Ibn Khaldun has my very favorite way of explaining away evidence against your theory. Because he says, look, one part of the theory is there's a lot of inertia in the process that takes long periods of time. But how can we then explain the early history of Islam? Because the Arabs come out of the desert, and in not much more than a generation, they wipe out one of the great powers of the area, the Sassanid Persian Empire, and conquer half the other. Clearly not consistent with all. He says, that's all right. Because we know that this was one of the miracles of our religion. that God put courage in the hearts of our warriors and maybe cowardice in the hearts of the enemy, and so we won. And it's a well-established principle of philosophy that scientific laws don't have to account for miracles. Isn't that a great out? Anyway. All right. Other things that struck people reading about this stuff that they wanted to talk about?
I was curious about the distinction between those offenses that could cause death, but only if the witness were to be at the trial and the execution, and this caught all Tariq,
highway robbery.
This is
the highway robbery.
Right, where that punishment seemed to be. Had to do that no matter what.
As far as I can tell, what's going on is that the one which they describe as highway robbery, but also includes sort of breaking into a home with armed and threatening people and stuff, is, from our standpoint, a criminal offense, and murder is a civil offense, just as it is in Iceland. So that what's going on is that the Quranic offenses are all offenses against God.
Right.
They may also be an offense against man, but they are, among other things, offenses against God. And since they're offenses against God, man can't pardon them. And consequently, and that's the only one which involves killing people. Yeah.
Right. Well, so then I was trying to think of how I could rationalize that when compared to zina, which is the adulterous one.
It's not just adultery. It's unlawful intercourse.
Okay. So, but either way, that appears to be an offense against God. More
and
than
yet you have to have the witnesses present.
Right.
Yeah, don't know. It's a good question. I don't know. That is, there's the general impression that having this rule for zina, they then try, as with some other things, to make it as hard as possible to convict someone on it. And part of the story there is that somebody accuses or starts rumors that one of Muhammad's wives has been unfaithful. And Muhammad then has another revelation, which is the one that says that it requires four witnesses, because most things only require two witnesses, that it requires four witnesses to convict him. So if you're cynical, you say, aha, he either didn't believe his wife was unfaithful and wanted to end the matter, or maybe he's afraid she was but wanted to end the matter, but for whatever reason. But I'm sure he believed in it. I mean, I think you have to assume that most of these people believe in what they're doing, even if you can at the same time have cynical analysis from believers of saying, well, it was very convenient to have that particular revelation at that time. But if you look at the relation between unlawful intercourse and accusation of unlawful intercourse, it's set up so that although the punishment for unlawful intercourse can be very high, it's capital, whether it's not capital punishment for everybody, it's capital punishment if you have previously had lawful marital intercourse. Which itself is a little weird. It's sort of the idea, well, you know, these poor people who are really hard up, you know, they're horny and they don't have a husband or a wife, then we want to punish them. It's not a capital offense. But if you've got a wife and, you know, you've perfectly good opportunity to have sex, why should you go around doing other things? And there's actually one of my medieval Islamic stories, or I won't go into it because it's a fairly long one, though it's a good one, but in which a soldier, a Turk, I think, has, while drunk, sort of dragged a woman into his house and presumably raped her. You know, in one of the tales, and he ends up in front of the caliph, who, as part of the story, has been notified about it, who's questioning him about, you know, why is he behaving? You know, don't you have slave girls, you know, who you're allowed to have sex with? Why should you dishonor an honorable woman in the street, kind of thing? And there's, again, that sort of interesting. I don't know, the Islamic attitude, or at least the Muslim attitude to sex doesn't really feel very much like either the modern or what we think of as a traditional sort of Western one, and that it's more nearly, I think, taken for granted, as it were. But that doesn't mean you can't do bad things about it. There's this great line from Muhammad: "Let a man account to me for what wags between his jaws and what wags between his legs, and I will account to him for paradise." Isn't that neat? So you have this situation where, on the one hand, it can be a very serious offense, but it requires four eyewitnesses to the same act, and they are themselves taking a risk, because if for some reason they don't win the case, then they are themselves guilty of a fairly moderately serious offense. Yeah.
I know that in the Western world, religion is becoming less like there are fewer religious people,
yes,
and the role that religion plays in their lives may be decreasing.
Pretty clearly, yeah.
My question is, given that religion plays such an important part of this culture, especially with respect to justice and the courts, is religion decreasing in prominence in those countries?
Yeah.
And if so, what role would that play in religion's role in, yeah, in society?
My guess is that the real distinction is not between Islam and other religions, but between rich developed societies and other societies. Because my impression is that the growth areas at the moment for Christianity are places like Africa. That there is, in fact, a schism that's been going on in the Anglican Church. I haven't followed it well enough to know the current status, where you've basically got one faction, which is sort of America and England, and which believes in women priests and isn't against homosexuality, and in general has, in a sense, a relatively modern and watered-down version, as it were, of the religion. And then there's another faction, which is largely supported by congregations in places like Africa, which says, no, that's wrong. We want, you know, the old-time religion, as it were. And it's splitting there, and I say that's within Christianity. Similarly, if you look at Islam, it's clear from the sources that a lot of sort of top-level Muslims in a lot of these societies took the religion less seriously than you think you should have. So that there are a variety of anecdotes about caliphs drinking wine, for example. And it's pretty clear if you look at the literature that wine drinking was something that everybody knew was forbidden and that many people did. And similarly, under Sharia, homosexual intercourse, I think, is automatically zina, is automatically prohibited intercourse. But there are a couple of famous essays in medieval literature which are basically arguments about the relative virtues of homosexual versus heterosexual sex. One of them is, I think, called The Debate Between the Page Boys and the Dancing Girls, with each of them, presumably the people who are the subjects of such sex, arguing their superiority. And there's another one, I think, is The Debate Between the Back and the Belly, if I remember the title. And these are famous essays. And there's an anecdote about one of the caliphs who preferred boys to women, and his mother, I guess, wanted to make sure she had grandchildren, and so she got some women dressed up sort of to look sort of like boys in some sense, and succeeded in getting him seduced that way. So it's pretty clear that there were a lot of people in the society who, in some sense, took the religion less seriously than you would think. But at the same time, there were these various sort of enthusiastic revivals. And so if I had to guess, it would be that even Saudi Arabia, I don't know very much about, but if I had to guess, it would be that the educated upper class in their personal life are not very good Muslims. But they may think it prudent as a political move to officially be good Muslims, given that that's one way of keeping the support of the population. But that's a guess. It's not like I know much about Saudi Arabia.
Well, the family routinely travels outside of Saudi Arabia and engages in all sorts of un-Muslim behavior, gambling, hiring prostitutes, drinking alcohol.
Drinking alcohol is a pretty clear
Case.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what you would
expect. It's taking place outside of Saudi Arabia, so everybody looks the other way. I mean, they got the private resort in Spain.
But as I say, in the case, there's one of the anecdotes I'll tell it to you, I think it was a different point, is that a certain holy man observed a barge on the River Euphrates laden with great clay jugs. And he asked a bystander what they were. And he was told that they were jugs of wine going to the palace of the Prince of the Muslims, the Caliph. And being infuriated at this violation of God's law, he seized a barge pole and smashed them, all save one that he missed. And he was taken prisoner and brought before the Prince of the Muslims, before Mutadid, the Caliph at the time, for judgment. And Mutadid said to him, "And who is it who has made you the Mutasib, the inspector of the marketplace?" And the holy man answered, "He who made thee Prince of the Muslims." And Mutadid was abashed at the answer and ordered that the man be released. It doesn't say he stopped drinking wine, but he's sort of embarrassed at the fact that he realized he ought to be obeying the law. And there's quite a lot of stuff with that general tone in the medieval literature, at least, that I've seen. Yeah.
Let me rephrase my question.
Yes.
So what I really want to know about is not just the 1%, the very rich, but is religion declining as...
But the point I'm making is that we are the 1%. That is to say that the developed countries like the U.S. and Britain correspond to the upper class of poor countries. Now, what's less clear to me is whether what's really happening is the loss of religion or the loss of traditional religions. that I would argue that if you really look at modern environmentalism, it's got a lot of the feel of a religion. That I like to complain that mandatory recycling ought to be considered in a violation of separation of church and state, because what that's doing is compelling me to engage in a religious ritual of a religion I don't believe in. And one could have a long argument about that, obviously, but certainly that would be not that there are, obviously there are sort of pragmatic arguments for environmentalism, but then there are pragmatic arguments, you know, against abortion. For almost any position that people hold for religious reasons, you can also make non-religious arguments for it. But I think if I interrogate myself, that to the extent that I sympathize with environmentalism, it's because I think of trees as things that ought not to be cut down, as large living creatures. And it would be nice if there are still deer around. So there's a sense in which, at some gut level, what's going on is not these things are useful to human beings, but these things are ends in themselves. And that seems to be really a religious impulse.
But the other question is, they don't allow that question to be asked. You cannot do ethnographic research in Islamic countries in which you ask, is there really a net decline in Islamic attitudes? That's not a type of research that's allowed.
I wonder if you're really right in practice, because after all, you wouldn't have to put the question in that form. You could certainly imagine a good Muslim saying, I want to know, you know, how much sin there is out there. And you could, I suppose, there have got to be a lot of Muslim countries where it's legal to sell wine because there are non-Muslims there and the restriction is only on Muslims, and you could see what's happened to consumption of wine.
Well, and as to the point that you just made, Muslim law is not just based on any religion. It's based
on a particular religion. That's right.
And so, while we may not be losing religion in the general sense...
Will they lose that one?
Will they lose this particular...
And I guess what I'm suggesting is that my conjecture is that a Muslim country that develops to the point where levels of sort of income and education and all the rest of it are at the same level as Western Europe or the U.S., my guess is that they will become less Muslim. But I could be wrong. That, as I've been saying for some time, that one of the really interesting things about the 21st century is going to watch what non-Western civilizations look like when they modernize. Because there's a real sense in which up to about 1600 to 1900, 1700 to 1900, all the important stuff was happening in Western Europe and Western European-based cultures. That's where the first crack in that's Japan. That Japan is the first completely non-Western country which can build ships that are as good as our ships, fighter planes that are as good as our fighter planes, that really has come into the same game as the European countries. Now it's happening. Clearly China... Korea did it, or has done it by now. Taiwan and Singapore did it a while ago. China is in the process of doing it. It may be that in the 20 years from now, some of the Muslim countries will be too. And I'm only guessing. We have a too small a sample size.
So then, taking the countries that you mentioned as examples, do you think that government will emerge as a stronger force or a more important force?
Than religion, you mean?
Yes.
Huh. It's an interesting question, because of course religion sometimes limits governments and sometimes allies with them. So it's hard to know. Yep.
What's interesting I find about this question is that the way you guys are analyzing the region, in the sense that there are a lot of very small, very rich countries in the Middle East that, as far as I understand, they're not necessarily losing
When you say very rich, do you mean the income of the country is very rich or that most of the people's income is?
Most of the people's.
I don't think it's true. That's my impression, though I may be wrong, is that the only rich countries in the Middle East are oil-rich countries.
Right.
And that the revenue is in the hands of the government, and some of it is used for sort of relatively generous welfare systems, but that largely the wealth is going to the ruling group in that.
That's true for most of the countries, certainly.
For Saudi,
Bahrain,
but I think it's true for UAE too, isn't it?
Qatar.
Uh-huh. I don't know.
That's certainly a country that the majority of the population is at or around Western Europe standards.
But are they at that as welfare clients or as real participating members of the society?
That's a good question.
Because those could be very different situations.
Right.
But the question is, are they people who could in fact earn a living at that level, who've got sort of the educations, the skills, the attitudes that go with being a normal member of a, you know, developed society? And I don't know of any. Lebanon might have been the closest a while ago. I don't know what the situation is now.
Destroy their wealth over time. 25 years since the Civil War.
Yeah, that does help, right. But in any case, so I don't really know the answer, but if I had to guess, it would be that the pattern there, as with the European, and of course the U.S. is more religious than Europe, Western Europe at least, and the argument I've seen is that's because we have an open market for religions, and therefore they get to compete to do the best job of converting people, whereas Europe has mostly had established churches, which have got some advantages and don't have to attract people in order to get funded. But I know I told you a story. It's either from Larry Iannacone, who used to teach here and who's an economist whose specialty is economics of religion, and I don't remember if it's his own experience or somebody he knew. It was in Sweden, looking at this very, very impressive cathedral, and on a Sunday, and he's talking to, I guess, the minister or somebody involved, and he says, and the minister is describing all the people, all the employees, essentially, the whole staff, the gardeners, the this and the that, and the American looks around and says, but there are fewer people from that here now at services. And the minister looks and says, but it's their job. Why would they be here except when they're working? And the point being that the Lutheran Church in Sweden is a state church, and presumably, I don't know what will happen in the future, but gets supported without having to stir up religious enthusiasm in the masses. Have I mentioned Hume's argument with Adam Smith over this question? Yeah, I did, because that's sort of an interesting bit of it. All right, other things that people wanted to say?
Well, I'm still really puzzled by how the Islamic communities can have four independent and mutually recognized traditions about what is and is not a valid statement or what is correct punishment. That strikes me as impossible. And yet you assert it's true.
Well, so do my sources assert it's true. Yeah, if I have to guess about what's going on, it is that most people are well-defined members of one community or another. That most...
You really can't shift that, between them. You can't simply say, I don't know that you, for purposes of this law or this my, crime, I belong
my
this
guess
crime.
Is that you might be able to shift in the sense you might marry somebody of a different one, but I don't think you get to shift during the case. That's my guess. And then the only issue arises with cross cases. An awful lot of things you don't have cross cases. If you imagine somebody is accused of unlawful intercourse, well, he's the one who's accused. It doesn't matter what the witnesses believe in. So it really, you would think it would only be in things like contract law or maybe tort law equivalents where an issue would arise. So that if you injure somebody, that comes under it might come under the parts of Sharia which are really a tort law for death or injury. So if you injure someone and he's in a different school, now you have a problem. And I presume, but I've never been able to get it. I mean, at some point, maybe I'll get an unambiguous answer out of someone who knows more than I do. And my guess is that in such a system, there is some rule, such as the ruler's court decides in those cases.
Wouldn't the
Ottoman Empire have the millet system in which people... which I think was more nearly geographical than what I'm describing. It was the same sort of system. And I do not know what happened when somebody from one millet had a legal conflict with somebody from another millet, whether that went under Ottoman law or not. It might have. Yeah, but I just don't know. But again, you have to think about the fact that these pre-modern societies are going to have substantially less intergroup dealing. And a lot of the intergroup dealing may be handled outside of the legal system. You may well have had trading networks and things where it was reputational enforcement, or perhaps an ethnic group which was trading with other members of that ethnic group, and they had their own ways of enforcing it. But no, all of this would be interesting things to look into and know more about them. And I sort of keep asking people. At one point, we had a guest speaker in this class who was a local Muslim with some sort of authority. I don't remember what. But his answer seemed to amount to, you know, we're all good people. We always manage to agree on these things. He didn't need to give a substantive answer to the question. It wasn't clear if he'd really thought about it. So other things? Yeah.
I thought it was interesting, just the notes on theft and stealing an animal or the other one where it talks about stealing perishable food. And how it seems like something that reflects the environment. And then naturally, if you're, you know, I think of these people as wandering, not through the desert, but something like that, you know, in a very Lawrence of Arabia style way. And it's a lot of it seems like a rationalization of, you know, we may have these harsh laws, but he just stole something that he wanted to
keep. The problem with that, basically, is that at the point when the law develops, these aren't Bedouin. That the impression you get, at least in the literature, is the Bedouin are almost outside of it. They're probably Muslims. But they're sort of outside, largely outside of Muslim civilization. You've got this pattern early on of a caliph sending a child to be raised for a while in a Bedouin tribe because they'll learn sort of the purest Arabic and sort of not corrupted by urban civilization sort of thing. Now, it may well be that if, as Schacht thinks, a lot of the rule was based on pre-existing Arabic custom, that might be coming out of what you're describing. But the society where these rules were actually being enforced was, you know, an urban society insofar as there was an urban society, you know, 1,000 years ago. It was sort of a pretty major civilization. So, you know,
well,
but
it's funny because it goes against, as a child, my conception of this part of the world would be Aladdin, you know, the Disney movie.
Yeah.
And I love thinking about how wrong they are in portraying most things.
Yes.
And I remember a scene where Aladdin, I think, steals an apple because they're hungry, and he gets chased around, and they're thrown in jail, and it goes fundamentally
against his laws. That's not quite right, because remember that Sharia that hard offenses aren't all of the law. So it isn't clear to me whether, it may be that stealing an apple would not be considered an offense at all, but it might also be that it would not be the hot offense, but would go under siyasa or something else that might be some punishment for it. That I just don't know. But again, I mean, the impression I got with the hot offense of theft was that it goes along with the stoning of the disobedient son. It's a system where you're stuck with the rule and so you interpret it away. And not as extreme. The disobedient son, it sounds as though the legal scholars seriously doubted whether anybody had ever been convicted under that. Where it's clear that people were sometimes convicted for the hot offense of theft, but at least there were an awful lot of ways of not getting convicted, I suppose, especially if the Qadi didn't want to convict you. There were a lot of potential excuses. Yeah?
So the other question I have is, the gates of interpretation are declared closed.
Yes.
For 300 years.
Yes.
But since there's no pope or final authority,
yes,
within the Sunni system, how can they possibly enforce such things? Seems to me someone can easily come along and say, there is a new interpretation out there.
The question is whether people believe him or not.
Yeah, but there's somehow, you know, 300 years after Muhammad, there's this critical mass of the belief that, in fact, we're never going to allow further interpretation to take place. That strikes me as, why would the power structure at that time have been willing to go along with it? Because being able to interpret the law is power.
Well, except that the political power structure isn't dealing mainly by changing Sharia. It's dealing by working through legal mechanisms outside of Sharia, through the Mutasi, Sahib, and whatever they call the Mushurda, I think,
sure,
the police.
There was a power structure of, you know, learned clerics who actually understood.
Power structure is an odd way of putting it, though, because there wasn't a hierarchy. That is, how do things get settled in science? Right? There will certainly be cases where people say, well, that particular argument is over. We'll go talk about something else. But, you know, there's no one seriously argues that Newton was right and Einstein was wrong. All right? Newton got a mostly correct picture, but this, and this, its query was wrong. That's settled. And, you know, somebody who wanted to revive Newton would have a very hard time doing it in the modern world.
Yeah, allow me to make a good parallel with religious interpretation, because these people were essentially putting themselves not quite out of business, but they're seriously limiting their ability to influence society.
But each person,
there's no more interpretation.
But remember that almost very few people previous to that had much influence. You're talking about a context where the normal scholar might put one more voice in favor of one interpretation or another, and you've got a handful of really influential people who get remembered for hundreds of years, who have schools named after them, Shafi'i, for example, who are doing it. And you can also see that the other side of it is to say, look, I want to be an expert in something. Well, if the law isn't determined, I'm not an expert in anything. I just don't have one more voice. But no, I am a scholar. I have read the works of the people who got the right answers, and now I can tell you the right answers. So there's an incentive in that side as well. Anyway, other things that struck people. All right, let me give you sort of a brief capsule history of Islam, along with a few books that I find interesting. The background is that part of the world has two great powers. One of them is the Sassanid Empire, the Persian Empire, and the other is the Byzantine Empire. And the Arabs are a bunch of different tribes, occasional small principality kind of states, and they ally with one or another of the powers on and off the but they don't really matter very much, so to speak. And most of them are pagans, but there are significant numbers of both Jews and Christians, and tribes that are Jewish or tribes that are Christian. And Mecca itself is an important pagan pilgrimage site. It's got the Kaaba, which later gets annexed by Islam, but it's I think probably a meteorite, I'm not sure, but some object which was thought of as somehow having some supernatural connection, so people came to see it. And Muhammad grows up in Mecca. He's an orphan. He's brought up by his uncle, if I remember correctly. And he eventually gets a job running a caravan for a wealthy widow. And he impresses her sufficiently that she marries him, his first wife. And he then starts having visions. And in the visions, the angel Gabriel is dictating poetry to him. And I gather that it is very good poetry. I don't read Arabic, so I can't judge myself, but it seems to be sort of the consensus view that the Quran really is impressive in that dimension for that language. And of the people around him, as you would expect, most of them think he's nuts. But a few find it persuasive, accept the religion he's preaching, become followers of his, and their numbers grow. And the number become large enough so that the people who don't believe in it are bothered by it, become hostile, there are threats of killing him, things of that sort. And eventually he, I think, first sends various of his followers off to Medina, which I guess is the next city over, so to speak. And eventually he and the last few flee to Medina. And I think by the time he gets there, his followers there have already established a fairly substantial base of support. And eventually he and they convert the population of Medina. Islam becomes more or less the official religion in Medina. There are a couple of Jewish tribes who he ends up fighting wars with. I should say it's pretty clear that Muhammad originally thinks he's a Jewish prophet. That if you look at the substance of sort of the worldview that's portrayed in the Quran, Moses is part of it, right? I mean, Moses was a Muslim from their standpoint. So was Jesus. That Isus ibn Maryam, Jesus, son of Mary, is a very important prophet. Not quite as important a prophet as Muhammad, but in the last days, Jesus comes back and announces the fact that Muhammad is coming, essentially. So he's a major figure from their standpoint. And he wins his various conflicts and then ends up with an on-again, off-again war with Mecca.
What year are we in?
5-something, I think 530 maybe. I'd have to remember, but I'm pretty sure it's sometime 530 or 630. It's later than 530, but I think it's some point in the 6th century is when this is happening. I could check it. What? 580? Is that it? Is that when he leaves? That's Hegira? When he goes to Medina. So 580 when he goes, so 570s is when the story is starting, more or less. So, and eventually he fights a war with the Meccans, and some combination of defeating them and bribing them, he gets them to agree, right, we'll welcome you back, we'll all become Muslims. And so at this point his supporters include the companions, who were the Mecca converts, and the helpers, who were the Medina converts. That's the sort of terminology that they use. He decides that the Kaaba has somehow fits into Muslim belief. I don't remember exactly what it is, but it becomes a Muslim pilgrimage site instead of a pagan pilgrimage site. And the Muslims start a combination of conversion and conquest, which is spreading Islam through the Muslim tribes. And at the point where Muhammad dies, they're sort of in the early stages of expanding it beyond Arabia. And when he dies, there's a conflict over the succession, largely between the companions and the helpers. And eventually it settles on Abu Bakr, who is probably his closest companion. He's the one who is behind him, or in front of whom, I guess, Muhammad is sitting on the horse or whatever it is when they escape from Mecca. And I think he's married to one of his wives is maybe his favorite wife. I'm not sure it's Abu Bakr's daughter. But in any case, Abu Bakr is seen as probably the closest companion. Now, there may have been a conflict between Abu Bakr and Ali. We don't really know, because the issue of Abu Bakr versus Ali is central to the Sunni-Shia split, which happens later. And it's hard to know how much is being sort of retrofitted. Ali is Muhammad's cousin and son-in-law. He is married to Fatima, who is Muhammad's daughter, and by the later period, the only surviving descendant. And the result is that I think, though I am not sure, that Ali's descendants are the only descendants of Muhammad. I don't think he has any other children, if I remember correctly. But in any case, Abu Bakr ends up, so to speak, winning out. And you get a little bit of a picture. One of the stories I sort of like is that after he is appointed to be the successor to the Prophet, to be Caliph, Abu Bakr says to his wife and daughter, "Now the Muslims will expect me to spend all of my time taking care of their affairs, and we will eat up all that we have. What will we do?" And so he takes a bundle of cloaks and goes off to the marketplace to sell them. I assume he was a merchant of some sort. Not entirely clear. And he's on his way to the marketplace when he meets Umar, who is another one of the companions who becomes important. And Umar says to him, "Whither away, Caliph?" And Abu Bakr says, "I'm going to sell cloaks in the marketplace." "But you're the Caliph of the Muslims. What are you doing to sell cloaks in the marketplace?" "Well, so I'm the Caliph of the Muslims still. My family has to eat. Come with me," says Umar. Now, the Prophet used to say that if the devil met Umar in his road, the devil would climb a high hill to get out of the way. Umar is a very forceful character, as we see later. So Abu Bakr comes with Umar. And Umar takes him to the man who has charge over the treasures of the Muslims, because the Muslims have been given success in battle, and they've got various loot and other stuff that is sort of their common treasury. And he says to this man, "Here is our caliph. What will you give him to clothe him and to feed him and his family, that he need not sell clothes in the marketplace?" And the man who's in charge of the treasury says, "To clothe him, I will give him one garment for summer and one for winter, and I will replace them when they wear out. And to feed him, I will give him one exile's pension, not that of a great man or of a little man, but of a middling sort, and with that one lamb each day to feed his family." And so it's commanded. And the next story, which really goes with this one, those two together, is after, when Abu Bakr is dying, he asks the people around him their advice with regard to his successor. And he says, "What thinkest thou of Umar?" And one of them says, "Thou knowest it better than I. Nay, speak and be not silent." "Well," the man says, "the Prophet used to say that Umar always spoke the truth, however harsh, and it was for that reason that he had no friends." And so Abu Bakr chooses Umar to be his successor. So Umar becomes caliph. And one day Umar is sitting in front of his doorstep with some of his friends. And a beautiful slave girl goes by, a prisoner taken in war. And one of his friends says, "Ah, that is a beautiful slave girl. She would look very well in the bed of the caliph." And Umar says, "Heaven forfend, she is not lawful to me." "Why is she not lawful to you?" "She's part of the treasure of the Muslims." But you are the caliph of the Muslims. What therefore is or is not lawful to you if the treasure of the Muslims?" "Ah," said Umar, "that I can tell you. What is lawful to me if the treasure of the Muslims is one garment in summer, and one garment in winter, and others to replace those when they wear out, and one exile's pension, not that of a great man nor of a lesser man, but of a middling sort, and one sheep each day to feed my family. That is all that is lawful to me of the treasure of the Muslims." And I like the story because you get the impression of Abu Bakr and Umar are really true believers. And then the next one, the third caliph, is not, as far as I can tell. He's a convert. He probably believes in the religion, but he really sees being caliph as an opportunity to enrich himself and his family, and that sets off various caliphs. And when Umar is dying, his relatives, I think, tell him to suggest that he not fast, because I guess it must have been the month of fasting, and they say he should give up the fast. If he ate something, that would strengthen you, and you would live longer and be able to serve the Muslims. And Umar's answer is, "I understand what you were saying, but I had two companions who took leave of me in a certain path, and I fear that if I depart from that path, I will not meet them at journey's end." So these are interesting characters. If you want a picture, there's a book which I really like, which is called Muhammad's People. And it's a history of Islam done as a pastiche from period sources. So its weakness is that he doesn't actually tell you this passage is from here. He has notes at the end which say this chapter is from the following sources. But he's running together chunks from different sources, but it gives you a feeling of how the world looked to them. And that seems to be one of the things you really like to have about societies. And at least the feeling, it may be all wrong. I mean, obviously you're going to have mythologizing about these people, about Muhammad too. But the impression one gets is that Muhammad and some of his companions, including the first two, And somebody said the luck of Islam was buried, wrapped in Umar's winding sheet. That he's the last of those. So I should say, when Muhammad dies, oh, there's this, also this scene. Muhammad, when he obviously knows he's dying, and he preaches his last sermon to the people, and he can't get up in the pulpit because he's not strong enough. So he sits on the ground and he speaks to the people around him. He says, "After death, there comes a day of judgment, and on that day, it will be no different with me than with any other man. Therefore, if there's any here to whom I have struck an unrequited blow or owe a debt, let him name it that I may repay it, that I may go before God guiltless of any debt to man." And the people said, "No, we are your debtors, prophet." But one man said, "There was a day when you commanded me to give 3 pennies to a poor man." And Muhammad said, "Better shamed in this world than the next," and pays him back the 3 pennies. And then he goes back into his home, and the people never see him again. And when he dies, Abu Bakr comes to his house, and there is Umar outside of the house, yelling to the crowd and saying, "These faint hearts say the prophet is dead. It is not so. Let those tongues be torn out." And Abu Bakr goes into the house, and he, I guess, lifts the cloak off Muhammad's face and looks at him carefully and sees that he's dead. And he goes back out, and he said, and Umar is still haranguing the crowd, and he said, "Peace, Umar, peace." And then he turns to the crowd and he says, "If there is any here who worship Muhammad, Muhammad is dead. But as for those who worship God, he it is who will never die. Do you not know the verse from the Quran? Muhammad is only a prophet. Prophets before him have passed away." And Umar later said, "When I heard that verse, it was as if the ground had been torn out from under my feet and I had fallen upon my face, and I knew that at last the prophet of God, God's peace and blessing, upon him was dead." Very, very moving scenes. I think you get more of a feeling for why Muslims believe in it when you sort of look at these pictures of the original founders, who were quite impressive people. Anyway, or at least as they see them. Again, we don't have a time machine, so half of this stuff may be bogus, but it's at least the picture they have. So when Abu Bakr takes over, they've prepared an expedition, I think, to Syria to conquer outside of Arabia. And various of his advisors, but they get news that some of the Arab tribes that had converted to Islam are now reverting away from Islam because they've heard that Muhammad is dead. And so various people suggest to Abu Bakr, "We should cancel those plans, thank you, and go nail down our base." And Abu Bakr says, "Heaven forfend that I should untie from the pole any banner that the prophet tied there." And he sends off the expedition to Syria, another expedition to deal with the rebel tribes, wins both of the cases, and the expansion goes on. So again, it's sort of neat stuff. So Abu Bakr dies, he's succeeded by Umar, and maybe next time I've got Abu Bakr, the translation of Abu Bakr's will, which he's basically naming Umar as his successor, and he says sort of at the end of it, if he rules you well, that is according to my expectation, if not, every job has its own wages. God will punish them, is the implication. So in any case, Umar dies, and his successor is Othman. And Othman, I think, was a fairly early convert, but from a family, most of which only convert after Muhammad's one. And Othman, as far as I can tell, sort of looking again at the stories, some of which may be biased, really is somebody who, yes, he's a Muslim, but isn't it nice being... he has, let's say, a wider view of what he's entitled to as the treasurer of the Muslims than Umar and Abu Bakr did. And so he appoints his kinsmen to important positions, and the core of the believers get less and less happy with him. And eventually, a delegation comes to him from Egypt, which has been conquered by this time, to basically complain that the person he's made ruler of Egypt is corrupt and doing various bad things, and that he ought to replace him. And under pressure, Othman agrees to replace him, and he gives the sort of the delegation the message to put maybe one of them, somebody else in charge, and they start back. And as they're heading back towards Egypt, they are overtaken by somebody riding, I think, a mule very quickly. And they seize the guy to see who it is, and it's one of Othman's slaves. And it turns out that he's got, I think, a bottle with a message in it. And the message is instructions to the ruler of Egypt that when these people go back, he's to kill them. And so they indignantly return, and shortly thereafter that, someone of the early people assassinates Othman. And at this point, they agree on Ali as his successor as the fourth caliph. And he was, you know, he was again part of the core group as well as being married to Muhammad's daughter. But Muawiyah, who is Othman's nephew and who is at this point the governor of Syria, eventually decides not to accept Ali. And that sets off the first civil war, in which you've got a civil war between the supporters of Muawiyah, who pretty clearly on the later evidence is a very competent sort of politician, ruler, and the supporters of Ali. And at a point when that war has not really been settled, Ali gets assassinated, I think for a reason unrelated to the civil war. You never again know for sure what's going on. And Muawiyah basically buys out Ali's sons. He offers to pay off their gambling debts and what else in exchange for their not trying to claim the caliphate. And nobody else is around, I guess, for the status to claim it. And so Muawiyah becomes the fifth caliph. And he's the founder of the Umayyad dynasty, which is the first Islamic dynasty. And Muawiyah, again, is an impressive character of a very different sort. An Englishman, I think, would say he has no side. He faces each person as a person, as it were. But is he a true believer? That's not at all clear. So that a certain Bedouin comes up to Muawiyah when he becomes caliph, and he says, Muawiyah, now that you're caliph, you'd better deal justly with us. And if I do not, said Muawiyah, we shall correct you. How will you correct me? Said the prince of the Muslims, with a stick. Well, said Muawiyah, I have best deal justly with you. And there's another quote from Muawiyah when he said that he will never lose his control over the people of Islam. Because, like a fisherman, when they pull, he gives way. And when they tire, he draws in again. And then there's this scene. There's another one where one of the supporters of the other side, a particular person who is relevant that I won't go into, says to him, you call this peace, but it is not peace while our swords that thirst for your blood are still in our scabbards and our hearts that hate you are still in their breasts. And Muawiyah says, that is a wise man. Write it down, someone. And later, there's one of my favorite Muawiyah stories. When Muawiyah is an old man, and the conqueror of Egypt, also an old man, comes to visit, and they're sitting there talking. And the conqueror of Egypt says to him, now that you're old, what things still give you pleasure? And Muawiyah says, women, I am too old for women. Fine cloth, I have worn cloth so rich and fine that coarse and smooth are the same to me. Rich foods, I have had enough of rich foods. What still gives me pleasure? To drink cool in the summer and to hear my children and grandchildren playing around me. How is it with thee? And the conqueror of Egypt says, a little land, enough to grow food for the family and something over for market. That suffices. And as they're speaking, the freedman Wardan, an ex-slave, who's a servant of the caliph, comes in. And he also is an old man. And Muawiyah says to him, what still gives you pleasure now that you're old? And Wardan answers, I still take pleasure in thinking that I may yet do some noble deed that will earn for me an eternity and live in the memory of remembering men. And the prince of the Muslims turns to the conqueror of Egypt and he says, enough of this talk. This slave is a better man than thou or I. So anyway, I think that gives you a little bit of a feeling for him too. And he's really the first, somebody describes him as the Arab Caesar. And he succeeds in establishing a dynasty that holds on for about 90 years, despite the fact that his son is not, I think, a particularly competent one. But that makes it, in effect, hereditary, even though in theory it's not. So that nominally the caliph is elected from among the Quraysh, which is the prophet's tribe, but that's a lot more than his direct descendants. And in practice, it's hereditary, but not primogeniture. It's not guaranteed to be the elder son. And to a considerable extent, the existing caliph controls the succession, though not completely. And you then have the Shia-Sunni split as arising out of all of this stuff, because the supporters of Ali are not very happy with what's happened, and there's an attempt at a rebellion, which is suppressed, and I think one of Ali's sons gets killed in the process of it. And you end up with the Shia are really originally the Alids, the partisans of Ali, as it were. And their position is that Ali should have been the first caliph, not Abu Bakr. I don't think they go so far as to say terrible things about Abu Bakr, but nonetheless, he really shouldn't have had it. And that now it really ought to be in his descendants. And the Shia also don't have faith in Geniger. So that one of the things that leads to the Shia fracturing is that they all agree that the authority goes in the line of the descendants of Ali, but they don't agree about which particular descendant in each generation it is. And eventually, they more or less give up the hope of taking the caliphate, accept the idea that the Sunni caliph is the secular ruler, the emperor, but the imam, the person they recognize as the successor, is the pope, so to speak. He's their resistance authority. And one result of their system is that unlike the Sunni, you have, as it were, a divine source for law for a fair while after Muhammad's death. The different schools disagree about how many generations there are. They're, the usual terms are the seveners and the twelvers. According to how many generations of popes, so to speak, there are before the last one goes into occlusion, vanishes, like Arthur hiding, you know, wherever Arthur, in Avalon or somewhere where Arthur is supposed to be waiting to save England at the end. Similarly, the last...
No, they're still here. I'm pretty sure they're still here.
But invisible. That's right. So it's same sort of effect. And at the end, he's going to come back. But that means that they can base their law not only on the same sources as the Sunni, but also on the traditions of the first and people after that, who they think were also divinely inspired. They sort of inherited some kind of a divine job from Ali. Basically, that's been a conflict ever since. The Sunni, I think, have always been the majority by a fair amount. At some point, not that long ago, maybe 300 or 400 years ago, Iran goes Shia, and Iran is still dominantly Shia. There are 12 Shias.
1700.
1700. That's right. So it's fairly late. That's what I thought.
Muhammad takes over Mecca and Medina in 620, and dies in 630.
Aha. Uh-huh. So it's later than So then 580 has to be wrong because he doesn't.
580 is closer than he was born.
Before. Yeah. That sounds better because he's not that old. Right. So it's a little later than I thought. So it's early 600s. And in any case, so the Umayyads run things for about 90 years. And pretty clearly, again, it's becoming a less religious, more corrupt, less competent dynasty. This is sort of the kind of thing that Ibn Khaldun is thinking about. And a rebellion is raised against them. And the rebels sort of let it look as though maybe they're sort of Shia, that they say that it ought to be a kinsman of the prophet who ought to be the caliph, but in fact they end up supporting the descendants of an uncle of the prophet, who Abbas was, if I remember correctly, who were the Abbasids, but they successfully run a rebellion which eventually overthrows the Umayyads and installs al-Mansur, I think, who's the Abbasid leader, is Abbasid, and one of the first things he does is to kill the general who's won the civil war for him on the grounds that he doesn't really have power as long as there's another very powerful figure out there. And after the Umayyads have conceded, the Abbasids hold a feast sort of to celebrate peace and invite the Umayyad princes to the feast, guaranteeing them safety, and slaughter them. And two of them escape. And they flee from the Abbasid troops until they come to the river Euphrates, and they plunge in to swim across. And the pursuers call after them that they will be drowned, but that if they come back, their lives will be spared. And one of them foolishly turns back and is killed, the other, Abd al-Rahman, swims on, crosses the Euphrates, travels to Egypt, crosses the Nile, probably didn't swim that one. He's basically running for his life, and he makes it all the way across North Africa, presumably pursued all the way, and he gets to the Straits of Gibraltar, the Straits of El Jabir, and he hears word that across the Straits of El Jabir in Al-Andalus, in Muslim Spain, many of the great men had been clients of the Umayyad house. That you have one of the patterns that happened with the Arab conquest is that non-Arab groups get sort of semi-adopted into Arab tribes, and I think that's what's going on. And so he crosses the straits, makes himself leader of the Umayyad partisans in Spain, and succeeds. The story, another one of the stories that I like, is that he, the al-Mansur, the Abbasid caliph, race is a big army, much bigger than any of any army that Abderrahman sends it against him in Spain, and Abderrahman is besieged in one of his cities in Spain. And at the last pitch of despair, he orders that a bonfire be kindled, and he calls about him the bravest of his followers, and he draws out his sword and flings the scabbard into the flames, and so do they all, and sortie out with naked sword upon the besieging army. And such was the fury of their attack that the besieging army was set utterly to rout and ruin. And when the killing is over, he has the heads of the leaders of the Abbasid army cut off and pickled in salt and camphor, and a label attached to each man's ear naming him. And they are put in a sack along with the Abbasid banners and the diploma of appointment for the Abbasid governor of Al-Andalus. And this sack is rowed across the straits and left in the marketplace at night. And it eventually makes its way to Al-Mansur, to the Abbasid caliph. And he opens up the sack and sees what is in it and calls out, "Thanks be to Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, who has set a sea between that man and myself." Anyway, I find the stories are useful ways of sort of getting a handle on all of this stuff. So in any case, Abderrahman, I don't think he actually claims the caliphate at that point, but he does become the ruler of Muslim Spain, and his descendants claim the caliphate. And thus, for quite a while, you've got the eastern caliphate, which is the Abbasid, and the western Umayyads, which is sort of what's left of the earlier Umayyad dynasty. And they rule Spain for a fair while, but eventually they also go into decline and essentially lose their power, well before the Christians reconquer Spain, that is. Back to the Abbasids for a moment. I'll give you another story. This is a story of Al-Mansur, actually. That there was a certain holy man, an ascetic, who before Al-Mansur became caliph, was a close friend of his. And on one occasion, he comes to visit the caliph. And the caliph says to him, "Give us some words of wise advice." "Consider that the power that is yours would not be yours if those who had it before you had been able to hold on to it. Therefore, remember that after day, there comes a night that is followed by a day that no night follows." And Al-Mansur says, "That's very good advice. I will give you a bounty of 10,000 dinar. I have no need of it." "By Allah, you will take it. By Allah, I will not." At which point, Mahdi, who is Al-Mansur's son, who is watching this, says, "Who is this? Who, when the prince of the Muslims says, 'By Allah, this will be,' says, 'By Allah, this will not be.'" And the holy man turns to Al-Mansur and says, "Who is this young man?" "This is my son, Mahdi. My son and heir. You have given him a name that is no name for living man." The Mahdi is basically roughly what comes back in the final days. "You have clothed him as no follower of the Prophet is to be clothed. And you have set him on a path where every success leads on to ruin." And Al-Mansur says, "Is there anything that I can do for you?" And the man says, "Only this. Promise that I will never come to you before unless I ask it. And I will never see you again." And he goes out. And Al-Mansur turns to the courtiers around him and he says, "You are all beasts of prey that go with stealthy step. He only is different." And this is, again, a pattern you see repeatedly in the stories, sort of the tension between the secular ruler and the religious. And, of course, it doesn't always go as nicely for the religious as this one, but some of the stories, at least, it's clear that the secular ruler, at the same time, sort of admires the holy man, as it were, even though he's not willing to be holy himself. In any case, Al-Mahdi then succeeds, and he's not a very able or good caliph, and his son is Harun al-Rashid, who is very famous. He's the one who shows up in the Thousand Nights a Night. In my opinion, he's an idiot, but he's a contemporary of Charlemagne. So if you want to tie the histories together, Charlemagne is crowned Holy Roman Emperor in 800 AD in Rome. And so that gives you a date, because he's a contemporary with the third of the Abbasid caliphs. Basically, al-Rashid is successful in part because he employs a family of Persian administrators, the Barmakids, who run his empire for him very well and get pretty wealthy doing it, and are later famous for their generosity. And eventually he turns against them, it's not quite clear why, and imprisons sort of his best friend and his best friend's father, who are the people who run his empire for him, and I think they eventually die. So not a very pleasant story. But in any case, al-Rashid has two sons who want to succeed him. Al-Amir and Al-Amun. al-Ma'mun. And so al-Rashid, who is not very bright, appoints the elder son to be his successor and appoints the younger son to be governor of the eastern provinces and swears everybody in sight to keep the peace between them. And as you would expect, once al-Rashid dies, civil war breaks out between the two sons. And on the face of it, al-Amin has got all the cards because he's the caliph, and besides, the eastern provinces have been in revolt off and on anyway, so they're not a very secure base of support.